The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.
You know, the revolt that is putting forward to try to do, as you said, bring about changes in governments, which they see as wholly illegitimate. We'll talk more on that, but I just wanted to pause you there for a second. Back over, and I guess I should have said that Andrea was telling me that she's a big fan of Monkey DeLuffy, and she reads most of those comics and was going to bring one in today. I was expecting to see it.
It was library borrowed.
So there it is.
But I mean, it holds true that symbolism and iconography, sometimes you can struggle to say exactly what it is that your grievance is. But this symbol or icon is able to capture so much sentiment in just one thing. And so I think that's why movements that have associated icons are often more successful in rallying people, because they can relate to something that they're seeing.
Aloha, and welcome to Strategic Voices. I'm James Minnick, Colonel United States Army retired and professor here at the Daniel K. Inouye, Asia Pacific Center for Security Studies in Honolulu, Hawaii. I'm joined today by my colleagues, Professors Sham Taquani and Andrea Malji. This is episode 5, Gen Z After Revolt. Is South Asia turning a corner? Across South Asia, youth-driven uprisings have shaken political systems to their core. In Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, and Nepal, protests have toppled leaders, disrupted entrenched elites, and exposed deep public frustrations with corruption, inequality, and unfulfilled promises. But disruption is not the same as transformation. Now, with elections completed in Bangladesh and Nepal, the question is whether generational mobilization has translated into durable political change, or whether established systems have once again absorbed the shock. After Gen Z after revolt, is South Asia turning a corner? Let's begin. Hey, friends. What's going on?
Hi, James. How are you doing? Good to see you, Ben. Good to be back.
It's good to have you back. We missed you last week.
I'm sorry I couldn't be here.
I know you couldn't, but it's good to have you here.
Thank you.
I thought to myself, if Sham doesn't show up for today's, we might have to postpone it, since we're talking South Asia, and this is your topic you put forward for us.
Well, I'm glad I made it.
Well, we're glad.
Thanks.
We're glad to have you. What you been up to, Andrew?
So I don't know how many people know that I am a college basketball fan. And so the month of March is a big month for college basketball, NCAA tournament. So I've been watching that. This past weekend was a big game leading up to the Final Four. And I'm from Kentucky. Basketball, college basketball is like a religion in Kentucky. And so even though my team, we got out, we didn't make it very far. We were out a couple weeks ago. But there was a major game this past weekend where our arch enemy, two of them, lost on the same day.
Oh, say more.
Duke and Tennessee. So even though it wasn't a Kentucky win, that's like the second best thing. So I'm watching closely. So that's what I've been up to.
Oh, if we can't win, at least our rivals can lose.
Exactly. There we go. Second best.
Well done. Well done. How about it?
The crab mentality.
Right? That is what it is. Sham, how about yourself?
Nothing as exciting and fun as Andrea, but I've gone back to a book which I read as an undergrad, The Social and Political Influence of the Potato. That's 750-page long. I remember reading it when I was an undergrad. Loved it, though I didn't understand most of it.
Mm.
So now focusing on doing research on critical minerals. And so I did a paper on the potato logic of power, which was on critical minerals. And I drew a lot, parallel with the potato in that book. And so I'm still plodding through the book. As I said, it's 750 plus pages. There's still parts of it which is dense, requires immense concentration, but that's what I'm doing.
Well, we talked about your potato logic last week. That really was a good paper. You know, with you, I too have something to add to the reading list of those who might be tracking. And so last week, a fascinating, I haven't read it yet. The book just showed up in my home. Amazon dropped it off. But Katrina Manson wrote a book, Project Maven, a Marine Colonel, His Team in the Dawn of Warfare. Now, I've listened to her in two different podcasts already. It just came out last week. I ordered the book. I'm looking forward to reading it. Obviously,
with combat operations going on in the Middle East, in the system and its use there. This is very timely. In fact, we'll do a show on this coming up. But I know personally the colonel that she talks about in this story. And so years ago, quite a few years ago now, I was an Army colonel leading the Afghanistan country program there in Virginia. And my wife and I, we knew him and his family. And so Colonel Drew Kukor is a great American. And so stories told in here. And so I look forward to reading. And obviously, when you read a story of somebody you know, you know, unlike your potato logic where you get lost perhaps in your 750 page book you're reading, I think this would be riveting for me. So looking forward to that. And take a look at it if you want to know more about the Maven smart system. And so cool. So Sham, you, like I said, you asked us to take a look at this, and I'm really glad you did because this was really enjoyable. But get us started and tell us what you're thinking about in this area here. Tell us maybe about some of the readings if you'd like, but get us started.
Yes, so I've been tracking South Asia, as I always do, and it just so happened one after the other, we had these revolts from Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, right up to Nepal, and I've been associated with each of these countries pretty closely. So it was but natural for me to try and understand what was going on there. And sure enough, there's been a lot of literature coming out on what is referred to as the Gen Z revolts. I chose three papers specifically, and I'll so we had Paul Staniland's analysis. Two papers were from the Journal of Democracy, and one paper is from The Wire, an independent publication in India, for who I contribute a column.
Well, that paper was yours, and it was
my paper.
It really was. It was a great paper, and some of the others came out last year. I think Chenoweth came out early this year, but you can say more.
That's right. So Staniland, as well as the other paper that I'm referring to, both came out early this year, in January. So Staniland's analysis, Why South Asia's Regimes Keep Falling, that focuses on the government collapse in Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka. And essentially, he's unpacking the chaotic aftermath of these protests and basically highlights the fact that leaderless movements, while they're powerful enough to tear down the old order, they often leave a power vacuum where elections alone aren't enough to build a stable future, and where we're tempting the military to step in. It's very tempting for the military to step in, and we'll talk about that. The second paper was Why Gen Z is Rising by Erica Chenoweth and Matthew Cebu. They zoom out. They basically provide a global perspective, arguing that these movements are fueled by a universal combination of economic insecurity and fury at elite greed. And you're going to see a lot of that playing out in these three countries that we're talking about. So they present a powerful paradox, both the authors. Essentially, while youth-led campaigns are remarkably successful at ousting leaders, they also face brutal repression and a difficult struggle to turn protest energy into lasting institutional change.
You know, I saw that piece, the statistics Chenoweth talked about. It was actually pretty significant, the point you just made. If I recall, she said something like, if 50% of a protest are young people, the Gen Z, that it has a significant percentage of possibility of achieving their result. And I went on and I looked at, and you actually know of Chenoweth, don't you were telling me, say.
Yeah, when I was at my previous institution, Hawaii Pacific University, I received a teaching fellowship that's based upon the work that Chenoweth has done for civil resistance about how to include that in our curriculum. So her book was a foundational part of that.
Yeah, and so Chenoweth is out of Harvard, she's a dean of faculty out there. But anyway, and she's done a lot of work in this field, like you were telling me about as well. And she has this rule, what is it, 3.5% rule. And the 3.5% rule is that if 3.5% of the population is engaged in this nonviolent protest, that 100% are successful. That's significant. Now, obviously, you can do the math, and that could be quite a few people engaged. But I think that you know, just buttresses the point you're making about these statistics that Chenoweth brings out, and so yeah, back over to you.
Yep. And so the last one is my paper, yep. The Age of Small Revolts and the Struggle to Turn Decency into Power. So I argue here the protests are unique and why they aren't driven by grand ideologies like socialism or nationalism, like you saw the protests of the past. Instead, they're revolts for basic competence, very basic competence, a demand for functioning governments, fair jobs, and an end to the casual corruption that has defined the lives of so many young people. And you can throw in nepotism here. Well, you'll see that happening in Nepal, which was a big issue. And that was incidentally inspired by what was happening in Indonesia, basically out Nepo kids.
Last summer, something like August or so, right?
Right. So together, all these three papers, they paint a complex, as for me, and fascinating picture of a generation armed with means, which is something that you're going to see more and more of. It's motivated by a desire for dignity, and it's fundamentally reshaping our world.
Yeah,
and I can say that for sure as far as South Asia is concerned. But I'll speak when it's my turn. Over to you, Wood.
We just pull just a minute on something you're talking about here, Sham, which is memes, or let me go more specifically into the iconography that Chenoweth brings out. And so yesterday, Andrea and I were kind of talking a little bit about this, but Chenoweth mentions the straw hat Jolly Roger flag, and which comes from One Piece manga comic. And so that comic actually has been around for some time. It came out in 97. And so we're going on 30 years of continuous publication. And they've put out like 114 volumes on this. And so it's really, really popular. And the protagonist in the comic is Luffy. And so Monkey D. Luffy, who is captain of the pirate ship, has, you know, a crew with him. And they're out there fighting this world government that is corrupt and oppressive on the people, and they're trying to bring justice to the plight of the people. And so this flag now has been used in so many of these Gen Z protests. Indonesia, you know, thousands of these flags out there. Nepal, other places. Indonesia went so far as to describing it as to be, you know, against the state to, you know, fly these flags. And so most people might see them and just see a comic, whatever, and have no understanding of the connection. But it is this iconography that can connect people across vast reaches that we're seeing here in this. And obviously we're going to talk a lot more about the Gen Z and the revolt that is putting forward to try to do, as you said, bring about changes in governments, which they see as wholly illegitimate. We'll talk more on that, but I just wanted to pause you there for a second. Back over, and I guess I should have said that Andrea was telling me that she's a big fan of Monkey D. Luffy, and she reads most of those comics and was going to bring one in today. I was expecting to see it.
It was library borrowed.
So there it is.
But I mean, it holds true that symbolism and iconography, sometimes you can struggle to say exactly what it is that your grievance is, but this symbol or icon is able to capture so much sentiment in just one thing. And so I think that's why movements that have associated icons are often more successful in rallying people, because they can relate to something that they're seeing. And I think that that's a good example. I'll just draw on a few thoughts that I was thinking as I read through these really excellent pieces. And so one was just thinking generally about how youth have often been at the forefront of protests around the world, whether it's, you know, anti-colonial protests, civil rights movements, student-led protests, in the color revolutions, Tiananmen Square, all of these were often, if not student-led, very student-heavy. And so I was trying to think, and I would like to discuss with you all, Is there something different about Gen Z? Is it about the role of social media that makes it different? Is this unique to Gen Z? But historically, we've seen a lot of youth involvement. It's not new. But I think one of the things that serves as a really mobilizing force, as in the cases that are discussed in these pieces, but also more broadly, is that there is a theme of just being sick and tired of corruption in the country. And often that is coupled with high levels of unemployment. And I'm thinking about in the case of Nepal and Sri Lanka, where so many of these workers are going abroad to work, that a large amount of the income that's coming back into the country is based on remittances. And in Nepal as well, for working for UN peacekeeping. So putting all of this together, if you're thinking about Gen Z and what you have seen in South Asia growing up, it's just a history of, you know, feeling unsettled, whether that's civil war or whether that's corruption, and just you feel like there's not opportunities for you, that if you have any opportunity, it's to leave the country. So why can't there be change at home? And so it's not just that students are, you know, idealistic and driven. They are, and they have been, but there's this buildup of corruption their entire life and lack of opportunity. And you saw this in the Arab Spring as well, that there's usually some event that serves as a breaking point.
For Nepal, it was, I guess, the social media ban on TikTok, right? And the backlash that caused. But yeah, continue.
Yeah, so even thinking back to the Arab Spring, that felt kind of like a millennial, I think that was seen as like a millennial protest, is that the Arab Spring was, this is going to bring change throughout the entire region. And so I asked the same question, is when Chenoweth talks about success, what do we mean by success as the end result? Is it that an election is held? Is it that the party was overthrown? If it's just that the party is overthrown, it's a lot easier to get to success. What is more challenging, which I think Shyam's article gets to, is like, what after that? You were successful in overthrowing the government and getting them to step down. But then where does institutional change come from? Where does normative change come from within the government to root out corruption? Not something that just elections can usually get at, because these are such embedded, they're so embedded into the institutions. So what does it mean to have success as the end result? Is it a, you know, having just the democratic election is also, it's an important first step, but it's not usually enough to change at the core of those grievances for most of these protest movements.
You know, I think this is less a story about youth protests, and it's more story about this declining political legitimacy. And I think it gets to the core of what you're talking about. I mean, this is systems, they're holding elections, but they struggle to convince citizens that in fact they're fair, that they're responsive, and that they can bring about any meaningful change. And as a result, they're fed up. And so I don't think it's anything unique about Gen Z. I think it might have something to do, as Shyam was talking about just a minute ago, about, and you double down on, and that is that it is this energy that comes from a younger population that continues to, irrespective of the period we're in, to mobilize and then to try to bring about some changes. And we've seen several changes that have occurred. Maybe we can even pull on some of that. The most recent in our region being Nepal last, what was it, September, when they had the protests, brought about elections early this month. And then just a few days ago, maybe Friday or something, then the new prime minister took office, and Balan Shah just took office, and he's unique in many regards. I mean, he's young, he's in his 30s, and you know, he's a former rapper. I don't know if you can say former, probably still rapping. But you know, his rap songs, and I listened to a couple, were you know, about the corruption in the government. And so, you know, former mayor of Kathmandu, and so he said, you know, I want to bring about this change as well. So here he is now, he's in the party, and the party put him forward as a prime minister. He's in office. You and I were talking yesterday, Shyam. Since 1990, when Nepal you know, embraced this multi-party democracy. They've had, I think this is the 33rd government, and none of them have completed five-year term. Now, I assume that Balan doesn't expect to be, you know, following that those footsteps, but it'll be less about the fact that he's a young person that, you know, can relate to people because he's a rapper, and more to do because he can bring about meaningful change in their lives. Over to you, Sean.
Yeah, I'll draw on both on something both of you said. I think number one, Andrea pointed out, it's in the DNA of South Asia. Mm. The feeling of being unsettled, the feeling of the need to revolt. It's in the DNA. You can't just, and it's the nature of the sub region. That's one. Number two, I would say is, if I look at all the three places, Sri Lanka, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. Now, again, what defines success? I think it'll be missed. We'd be erroneous to think of success as something that happens overnight. Elections is one. The way I would grade success is, have they achieved something that will enable them to make those institutional reforms and changes? Have they reached that point? So if I look at all the three elections, I would suggest that Nepal has reached that point because they were able to throw out all the legacy parties. Now, this is a party that came out from left side. Nobody saw it coming. He's 35 years old. He became the mayor when he was 31 years old. And all that stuff. So I think as far as Bangladesh is concerned, it's a legacy party that's back. And
that's right.
And
I mean, say more about that, but you're talking about the Hasina and the
Khalida.
Yeah. And they've been back and forth. I mean, the current prime minister's mother was the prime minister before.
And father.
And father was the former of the formed the party,
and
the BJP.
Also the strongman. He was also in the military. So what I see in Bangladesh is its legacy. The legacy party continues. All that they were able to do. And each of these revolts had a trigger. Each of them. Nepal, ban on
TikTok.
On social media. TikTok. Now, which obviously affected remittances.
Yep.
One third of the economy is dependent on the remittances. In Bangladesh, what broke the government essentially was, and she was a long-standing ruler, more than 15, 16 years, Sheikh Hasina.
And didn't they have the students were, they were upset because they couldn't have, they couldn't see upward mobility. They were giving it to the,
they had a quota system.
Yep.
So veterans and their children and relatives and uncles and aunties and crocodiles and dogs and cats and the
they all had priority.
They had 30%. So they were, which basically meant less opportunity for them. And so they tried a last minute tactic. Let's bring it down to, the Supreme Court stepped in and said, bring it down to 5%. But then it was too late.
Yeah.
There was enough bloodshed and all that kind of thing. It just propelled out of control. Sri Lanka, you had the economic collapse. You had a leadership.
Rajapaksa.
Which was living in Kukulan.
Yep.
And 15 of the last 18 years, they ruled the country.
Right.
And the economic collapse. And there, the it was not so much, if I look at the percentage, Nepal had 56% below 30 years old.
Yeah, that's significant.
56% below 30. And that's what has given Balan Shah a majority unlike before.
Yeah. I mean, they almost had a supermajority. They're two votes,
short
two seats short. So I think what, 182 or so.
You're right.
And the former party, Oli's, the Maoist party was what was it? It was
it was a
30 something seats or something like
it
that.
It was very a few. Coalition, you know, in Nepal before Balan Shah. So this is unprecedented.
Yeah.
Almost unprecedented. There has been one instance way back in the, I'd say it's 1959 or thereabouts, that they had absolute majority, 182. I mean, they didn't have that many seats then in Nepal. So coming back to Sri Lanka, the it was less than 20% youth. Bangladesh had 28%, half of Nepal's. So what happened in Sri Lanka, of course, was it was backbreaking, mile-long queues for gasoline and food and fuel, agriculture, and the doldrums. It was slightly different. And they, it was more about getting rid of the corrupt people, because it was that was a big thing. In Nepal, it was clearly, the objective was clearly not just the overthrow. And Nepal has seen too many overthrows. The monarchy was overthrown. Prior to that, the monarchy was almost wiped out by a crown prince, and so on. So in the case of Nepal, it was clearly we got to change the institutions. In Bangladesh and in Sri Lanka, I don't think it was so much about changing the institutions as much as we got to get rid of these fat cats. I mean, people who are not doing much. So I want to highlight that. And then the last thing I would say about that is each movement learned from the other. And like I said, Nepal learned even from Indonesia as far as Nepo kids go. So I think that is also very informative. Now, I go back to something you said earlier, that there's nothing distinct about the Gen Z crowd, because as Andrea pointed out, and as I keep saying, that it's every generation has youth.
They have different tools in this generation, yeah. But they're still youth. Yeah.
Yeah, every generation has youth. I mean, most of these are led by youth. I remember when I was barely a teen, and where I grew up in Tamil Nadu, as a North Indian living in South India, I was swept by the youth revolt against the Hindi imposition by New Delhi. They were trying to impose Hindi on a southern state to make it a national language. And don't ask me why, but I thought, no, you can't. And as I said, I was not even a teenager at that point in time, but we were swept by the movements. Yeah. So with Gen Z, there are two things. Mm. One, of course, is the technology. And they had, I think, sufficient practice during 2 years of COVID when they were isolated. I think they really picked on, learned these tools. I think that was one. But more importantly, the senior, the elder generations have always looked down at Gen Z as, you know, good for nothings, just drifters, buried into their phones and incapable of anything. I think that is surprising, as that's misreading the Gen Z crowd. Just because they have their noses buried in their instruments or whatever it is, it does not mean that they're not moved by the injustices and the corruption and what have you. I would say that's what distinguishes Gen Z from the other generations, as they were written off as totally immune, I mean, just oblivious of all the social, political, economic churn that goes around them. And what these demonstrations have proved is, no, they are very capable of doing it, and they can do it better, simply because they have a new tool.
Yeah, the tools to do it. You know, as you're talking, as I mentioned, I think this is less a story of this youth protest. It is more a story about declining political legitimacy. And so about 20 years ago, I did Korea National Defense University and doing a senior service college there. And I did a thesis, and it was on political legitimacy and President Park Chung-hee. And so I looked at political legitimacy. You know, it rests on two things. It rests on acceptance and performance. So when we're thinking about acceptance, we're talking about the right to rule. And performance, we're talking about your ability to govern. And if these things come out of balance, or not enough is going, if you're not doing both of these, there are going to be problems. And as I looked at these case studies and others, you can see where in here rests. But when we think about, you know, if we're thinking about the acceptance of governance, you know, we're thinking about elections. Andrea brought this up. Are they doing elections? Yes. Are they constitutional order? Are there procedural fairness? Is there institutional trust? And if you don't have these things, your right to rule,
your acceptance is going to be diminished for certain. And then what have you done for me lately? Performance. What is your ability to govern? Are we talking about, you know, your provision of economic opportunity, your basic services, your order, your competence, your fairness? And so if you've got Gen Z saying, there's no economic opportunity here for me, then you're in a risk. Say more.
I was going to suggest that acceptance and legitimacy.
So legitimacy, I said, had two parts, acceptance and performance.
Yep. Performance, yeah. So if you look around the world, you have governments whose performance is utterly, utterly shoddy. It's utterly non-existent. But they survive and they thrive simply because they were careful enough to be as adept as Gen Z in the use of these tools to create this facade of great performance. When the performance really, and I'll tell you one thing, when the crap hits the fan, it's going to be bad.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And so you are now in a precarious situation if that is. And so one can argue that we have seen this in South Asia where we talked about Sri Lanka. And so, or better yet, let's go to Bangladesh. So Bangladesh, they were providing economically. There were, it was a bit uneven. They were providing, but there became, legitimacy issues with regards to their acceptance, their right to rule. Nothing but the same governments coming in and going out and those that are being able to move up. And so absent having both of these things, it becomes quite risky. If you can get both of these things moving forward, people can give you a benefit and let you keep on doing some things because they feel like tomorrow looks better than today. And if you can keep that going, people say, not all there, but you know, it's okay. But you get one of those out a place. And so you may have some legitimate issues with regard legitimacy is not flagging in regards to your acceptance, but if you can't perform. And so we looked at this and when I looked at President Park Chung-hee, so he came in illegitimately. He took over in a coup. But oh my goodness, his performance was has brought South Korea to where it is today from all the things that he did. And so this was always this tension is he came in through an illegitimate fashion through a coup. And yet he produced like nobody else. And so that's why they've constantly struggled with these things mentally on how to accept them. But you get both of those things in order and government usually goes better.
I'll probably add one more. Yeah. To be seen to perform as opposed to performing.
I think you're right. But I think when we have those things, you end up being under pressure. You are a crisis away. You're a trigger away. Things can lead us to that. What are you thinking, Andrea?
Yeah, so I'm thinking back to our episode two times ago where we were looking at disruption and division, and I'm thinking about when you're talking about acceptance, how even if there are elections and even if they're determined to be free and fair in a highly polarized society, it can be very difficult to come together and rally behind the candidate that's selected, even if it is a free and fair election. So there can be an acceptance absent free and fair elections. So I'm thinking of just like really strong one-party states. You may be unhappy with them, but you accept that they are in power, especially if they have the tools of the state that will crack down on you if you resist accepting them as the authority. So that's why a lot of strong-armed, highly militarized states are able to survive, is that they have the acceptance. But when we get to the performance element, right. If the state is a one party or authoritarian state and but they're still giving out goods and services, there's low unemployment, then there's going to be a higher satisfaction, which will lead to a higher acceptance. So I think what was missing in much of South Asia in the cases that we're talking about today is both of these things, is that even if we do have an election and even if an outside party says that it's free and fair, at the end of the day, I don't see this government as legitimate. And also my personal situation is not great. All of my friends are unemployed. I don't see job opportunities unless I leave this country. And there's just, it's very bleak. And that feeling of it being bleak and that the government here is not going to be able to provide that, that leads to outsiders like we talked about with Belinda Shaw and other parties, even in Sri Lanka, political outsiders that were able to be more successful outside of the dynastic politics, that those are seen as alternatives, and they're at least given a chance because it's seen as like there's not many options, but at least let's try some political outsider. And this is not just unique to South Asia. This is all over the world that a political outsider is seen as can be more disruptive to the status quo that might be able to provide the change that they feel that they need.
So I would agree with you. The question is not whether these pressures exist across the region. They do. I mean, it's, but how is each country managing them? And this was getting to some of the things we've mentioned here. So how are they managing them? And so we're talking here today. So, you know, security practitioners might think more broadly on this. We have seen such an experience going on throughout the region that has caused these changes. And so put forth that, okay, we've got different problems, different issues. How are we going to manage those things? And so thoughts, I'll stop there for a second. But,
A discord election.
What do you mean?
So in Nepal, after the government was forced down, then there was probably the world's first sort of...
Oh, where they came forward and put full...
They on Discord, right?
Discord.
Who our interim leader is going to be.
That's right.
So that was a really interesting artifact of this past
year. Yeah, they did that on Discord, but it wasn't so different than how Bangladesh did it, because the students came forward and they put forward... Yunus, right? For him to come forward, and he led for months.
Right.
Professor Yunus did before.
More than a year.
Yeah.
So I think going back to your question, how will they manage it?
Yes.
We had this conversation and dialogue, I think a year and a half, two ago, about Sri Lanka. And I expressed apprehension about the fact that this was an inexperienced young team. And if they weren't going to consult or at least learn from the mistakes of their, you know, forebears, or if they rush too quickly to make those changes, that would mean trouble.
Mm.
Well, I'd like to think so far, again, in Sri Lanka, the party that came to power was not really an outsider. It was not a legacy party. The JVP had been around since 1970s, first as an extremist outfit, and then again it came out in the 80s. Both times it was militarily squashed, and then they decided to go political. They set up a political wing, and so they had members of parliament for a while also as part of the coalition. So that was not really totally external. It was part of the system already. But I think so far, so good, I would say. Not excellent. I mean, I would just say they got pass marks.
This is Prime Minister Dissanayake.
Dissanayake, yeah.
Dissanayake.
He's measured. We'll see how the rest of the cabinet plays out. I'm still keeping my fingers crossed on that one. In Bangladesh, again, it's a legacy party. They made all the right noises. We're going to be one country, no difference between, you know, religions and economic groups. We're going to make sure to uplift everybody. All the right noises. Let's see how that shapes out. In Nepal, however.
And that was in Bangladesh, talking about Prime Minister
Tariq Anwar. Nepal, now we have Balan Shah, who's young and eager, enthusiastic. Lot of energy. Now, I'm already concerned a bit. Now, he's sworn in at 12:34 p.m. the astrological
chosen time. 1, 2, 3, 4. I love that time.
12:34, 27 March. And what do you know next? He's got the former prime minister Ali arrested the next day. And he's got one more minister arrested. Great optics. But I don't think it's prudent way of doing things. Number one. Number two, you can always have been attributed to, you know, youthful indiscretion. A few months ago, at around midnight, puts out a tweet, now deleted, expletive America, expletive India, expletive China, deleted the tweet. And then for expletive all other political parties in Kathmandu, the tweet is deleted. Some of us have a copy, but so I'm just a bit concerned that this smells of rashness. It's a bit rash. I'm not suggesting don't arrest Oli. I'm not suggesting don't arrest the corrupt, because that's one of the platforms you came to power on. But there are ways of doing it. And so my concern is this is the only country where you do not have a political, you have a political party which is brand new, sparkling new. It's got a brute majority, great mandate. The youngest, I mean, he's 35, he's a prime minister. The oldest member of the cabinet, 15 people in the cabinet, is 51 years old. Compare that to the rulers, I mean, the people who ran Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. They were 78, 79, 76.
Some would argue out of touch with
the realities.
Needs of the, well, over the needs of the people that,
yes,
that put you forward. In
absolutely, yeah. Absolutely. So I think it's great to have youth there. I think it would be prudent to have a guiding hand so that, you know, you channelize that energy into more constructive things than doing things out of rashness and for the sake of optics. So that's my concern as far as Nepal is concerned. Now, if they're able to do that, I think that country will be transformed beyond belief, because they seem to have the right ideas. Now, how, and it's an educated cabinet. Most of them have degrees, just, they, you know, they're literate. 4 out of the 15 studied in India, and which is not unusual, because even the past leaders in Nepal have studied in India and got their PhDs, et cetera, there. So I think it's young, it has great energy, good ideas, but it needs some temperance.
Well, this less than a week in office, first time leading at this level, without a doubt, you know, having led lots of things over many years, you can make missteps, but what will matter is the fact that you stay focused on those things that brought you there, and that you are responsive to the people that elected you.
Absolutely.
And that, and so, as I think I started out, will this be the 33rd government that doesn't complete a term, or will this finally turn the corner? And without a doubt, the people in Nepal are hoping for something which is going to bring about meaningful change. And so hopefully that is where we go in here. And we'll certainly keep looking to see where this goes. But, and we get plenty of wonderful fellows that come here to the course that come from Nepal. They'll have stories to tell when we bring them in for comprehensive security cooperation course, which will be in mid-May, right? May and through June.
Yeah, the danger in Nepal is, and it's not, it's lurking, which is you have pro-monarchists who want the monarchy back, and then you have the pro-Hindutva, much like in the Indian Hindutva Brigade, who want the Hindu kingdom back. It's not that, because there's a sudden gush of youth out there, sudden rush. It doesn't mean those dangers have gone. So any missteps, and all those vultures circling.
No doubt, leading at this level is challenging. A lot of eyes on you. I hope it goes well. We'll see.
Of course.
What are you thinking in this region, Andrea?
I'm thinking, you know, as we talk about bigger picture, with geopolitical competition in the Indo-Pacific, and we have all of these new governments that are thinking about how to orient themselves both within the region and within the world, is they have decisions to make about how they want to align, whether they want to continue some of the history. Nepal historically very closely aligned with India, but there's been a lot of growing frustration there as well towards India. Same with Sri Lanka. You know, Sri Lanka wants to really assert its autonomy, and it has aligned very differently depending on the administration. I had a fellow from Sri Lanka said this is, we call it like a smart alignment. He didn't like the term hedging. He liked smart alignment, is that we're going to choose based upon our interests. And so we had a disagreement over terms. And so that's what I'm thinking about, is like, as we see these transitions and these new governments not only have to think about youth unemployment and remittances and crime and education and social services, but they also have the bigger picture of how are we going to align ourselves? Who are our alliances going to be? Are we going to, you know, cooperate more closely with certain countries? Do we want to make changes? If we're overhauling everything, maybe Nepal wants to kind of make some distance with its previous close proximity.
I mean, it's sandwiched right between India and China, right? It's got some great, location of its territory. Really tough neighborhood, right?
Yeah. I think I remember in one of Sham's lectures, one of the currencies that they had chosen a select picture of some disputed territory to kind of, you know,
oh, yeah,
speaking of iconography and boundaries. Yeah.
What do you think, Sham?
So I was just saying the interesting thing again is all these three countries, Nepal, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, before the new governments came, and there was a very strong anti-India movement.
Yeah.
Get out India, go back India. Yep. And with these new people coming in, all the three governments, right down to Nepal, and they've all seen as pro-China.
Yep.
Now, after the elections, they've all come out saying the same thing. We're going to be equidistant from both the powers. We're going to be pally with this, pally with that. Now, how far that translates into a practical reality will depend, in my estimate, it'll depend largely on how India handles its relations with these countries, with these three small countries. And I think it's very clear that three countries want to be friendly with everybody because it's in their interest. It's going to be, again, and if you look at the past, India ceded that space to all these small countries by its behavior to them. And now unless India picks up pieces and realizes that if we really want to keep them in our camp to the best of our ability, we got to behave. And I think really it's got less to do with these small countries saying we want to be pro-China and anti-India. It's got more to do with how India deals with the new situation and all these. And India has interests. It wants a different thing in Nepal. It wants something, and let's face one more thing. All these three new governments, they are very nationalistic, no less nationalistic than India, except they don't bring in religion into this, but they're no less nationalistic. And they've all found a voice. All of them have finally learned to speak. They know their place under the sun, and they know they can, if necessary, have to play one against the other if their survival calls for it, so be it.
One thing I've noticed with our fellows here is that there is this feeling that India can be somewhat paternalistic in its dealings with them, that there's just an automatic assumption of alignment with India just because it's within the region, and they really want to push back and assert their own autonomy to make decisions rather than just assume that, you know, because we're South Asia, because we have similar cultures and histories, that we're going to automatically align with India. So they really do want to kind of push outside of the boundaries of just saying, oh, well, of course they're aligned with India.
I mean, as soon as the elections were won by Shah and his party, India came out with his usual trope, get so tired of hearing it. Oh, we are civilizational allies. We grew up together. We are friends and da 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 da. And every time India does that, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing, whether good things are coming or bad things are coming in the way. But and I don't think that sells as much as it used to in the past in these countries, especially in Nepal. We are civilization allies and long lost friends, et cetera, et cetera.
Hmm.
I diverted a bit, but bottom line I'm trying to say is all these three countries, they are now, I think they're going back to great power and all that stuff, a lot has got to do with how India behaves.
You know, when we talk about things like this, I constantly, my mind goes back to the Bob Dylan song, Times They Are Changing. There's plenty of change happening. And then my mind wants to go to our talk of disruption, division, and competition, and which is a whole different environment to say.
I was going to say, when you say times are changing, then there's opposite to that. The more things change, the more they remain the same.
Fair enough.
So
fair enough. Well, how about if we transition? Let's talk about wins and woes. And so, Andrea, would you kick us off with your win?
Yes. So my win is related to a recent statement released last week from the PIPER countries, which stands for the Indo-Pacific Industrial Resilience. That's 16 members.
We actually kicked that off here, didn't we?
We did.
So
yeah, and there is, I'll highlight a couple of things and then I'll end with what I was the big one specifically, I think, for us here, which is committing to a project to establish a forward deployed F-100 engine repair hub in Japan. Good. Establishing a CH-47 Chinook engine repair hub in Korea, and a new solid rocket motor production initiative between the US and Japan. But also one of those paragraphs mentioned is specifically a course that originated here, which is MARS, the Multinational Armaments Resilience Seminar. It is highlighted in this joint statement about that it was successful and that it will continue on. So seeing that coming out in that joint statement this past week, I think, is a major win, not just for the PIPER countries, but also for APCSS and the success of our MARS course.
Well, this administration and the previous mentioned at the Sri Lanka Shangri-La.
Yeah.
I have my mind on Sri Lanka. On the Shangri-La dialogue, this initiative, and obviously now MARS is being highlighted as well. That hats off to the center and the good work they're doing in advancing this work.
Yeah,
you're engaged in this a little bit, aren't you? Aren't you about to be?
Yes. So our first week of MARS will happen in May, and it's kicking off in DC. I've mentioned in previous episodes that I'm part of the team that's going for a visit to Australia to help prepare for our June 1 week course in Australia. So it's four weeks over several months that will happen. And so we're about to kick off week one here in DC.
Wonderful. That is real goodness. You know, Sham Lamy and I did a lecture together, a panel on this. We had a course in from joint course, and we talked about this issue. And anyway, this is fascinating. It's good to be engaged in this work at this time because there's so much going on.
Yeah.
Thanks for that. Sean, what are you thinking for your win?
My win, I didn't have any big hurdles to cross this far for my US-India Defense Industrial Base workshop, upcoming workshop. That's number one. It's progressing quite well, better than I thought it would. Number two is likewise with the Transnational Security Cooperation course, the senior level course. I don't know if I should be worried that I haven't had major hurdles in my way yet, but I think that fact that I don't have any hurdles yet is a win.
So I was reading in the news here last week, up in Pyongyang in North Korea, the Belarusian president, Alexander Lukashenko, he did a state visit there. So this is the first time he has gone to Pyongyang and met with Kim Jong-un. And so I thought to myself, is this a win for the, or is this a woe? And as I thought about this, then my mind went to the Chinese story about the farmer whose horse runs away, and his neighbors say, "Oh, that's terrible." And he says, "Let's wait. Let's give it time. Let's see what happens." And so the horse then comes back with a whole bunch of wild Mustangs, and so now he's got many more horses, and his neighbors are like, "Oh, that's wonderful." And he says, "Oh, let's give it time and let's see what happens." And then his son is out riding. One of the horses gets bucked off and breaks his leg. And of course, you know, the neighbors are like, "Oh, this is terrible." And the farmer says, "Let's give it time. Let's see what happens." They come through conscripting for the war, and they can't take his son because he's got a broken leg. And they're like, "Oh, what great news." And he says, so you get this. So it's real difficult to know whether something is good or bad at the moment.
Yep.
And so I'm going to put forward something right here that could be a win. One could argue it could be a woe, but so Lukashenko, he's in Pyongyang, and he's meeting with Kim Jong-un, and they sign friendship agreements that, you know, cover agriculture and education and healthcare and commerce and et cetera, et cetera. Lukashenko says, establish immediately an embassy in Pyongyang. And so they're really moving this stuff forward. You say, okay, so how does this, if you step back a bit, the United States, under the present administration, back in January of last year, started improving relations with
Belarus. And so just recently, this month, I think it was the 20th of the month, we had a special envoy in there, Cole, and he met with and helped get released 250 prisoners from Belarus. So a real win for many in the region as they were released. The U.S. Has lifted economic sanctions on them, and there's a lot that is moving forward. You know, potash is a crop fertilizer that Belarus is big in producing, one of the third largest. And as we know, fertilizer is needed more on the market today because of operations going on in the Middle East. And so, it'll be, as I was thinking about this, I thought, well, here's a distinct possibility that Lukashenko could end up being a mediator with the United States and North Korea, as President Trump has been looking to reestablish engagement there, because there are real issues that are happening there, that the threat is just increasing. And so we'll see whether or not this happens, that Lukashenko fulfills this role, but he is certainly now playing in both areas, and there's a possibility. So, Whoa, over to you.
Okay, so I'm going to follow the theme a little bit. So mine is not a clear-cut win and woe, because it has a little bit of both of them, and it's also, let's wait and see. I'm going to take us to Mongolia. So Mongolia, just there on Friday, their prime minister resigned.
Yes.
And they have a new prime minister. So now they're, and this is not the woe part, there is now two former or rappers within the region. So Mongolia's new prime minister is also a rapper, former rapper.
Timon.
Yeah, so we have Nepal and we have Mongolia. So not bad that the rapper, right? But the fact that this is the third prime minister in like 9 months,
yeah,
that part is not great, because it shows some of the internal instability. It's, you know, within the party, but also there's just a corruption problem. Speaking of, you know, it's
things we were just talking about.
Yeah, Mongolia not ranked great on internal corruption. It's something that they're working through. My win portion of this is more so that, you know, Mongolia is in a really tough neighborhood, but they have continued to carry on these elections and select new leaders to address what they feel are some of the problems that are happening within the country. So the fact that there is a continuation of their elections and their political system is, you know, able to go through some of these trials, I think is part of the win portion. And I think I'm going to put the rapper in the win part as well. The woe is the internal corruption and the third prime minister.
I have listened to a little of his rap as well. Really? Yes, I did. I'm not a rapper, but you know, I want to see what people are saying.
We can use it for our intro music. Yeah.
Well, perhaps. So let me give you one, and then we'll go over to Shaman. So I was reading in the Japan News, and not surprisingly, but reaffirmed that North Korean workers are increasing within the region. And so North Korea exports a lot of its labor as well, kind of like we spoke about before. Russia has, and this has been, I guess I should note that this was prohibited in 2017 by UN Security Council resolution because of their development of nuclear weapons. Bottom line is they're pushing these numbers back up again. And so they were at 15,000 estimated in April. And then at the end of the year, they were up to 50,000. And so, you know, that of course, on top of the 150,000 or so that are in China. And of course, all this money that comes back to the country, and so much of this then, and it's estimated, you know, 90% of the money they make all goes back to the government. And this is all funneled back into what is a very large and demonstrably significant defense industry modernization that's going on right now. And so therein is the woe I give us. Okay, Sean, you're woe.
I don't want to, you know, break from the mold. Mine is also woe and win. It's the woe is this. After the Potato Logic of Power was published, I mean, I got over 100 responses, all in, you know, a lot of them insightful. But I was very disappointed that not one person noticed that the atomic number for germanium on the periodic table was wrong. It's 32, but the atomic number in the graphic, which was produced by the graphics department, AI, using AI, was 33. Mm. So nobody noticed that.
And we did a sanity check.
At least I was expecting people who wrote back. You know, some of them are.
I'll give you a nasty note on your LinkedIn account for that.
Okay, please do that. So that's the woe part. The win part, this is for those who are increasingly dependent on AI for their life and in their lives. You couldn't get a better live demonstration of watch out, don't believe everything AI tells you, because this graphic was generated by AI. And so AI got the 32 and 33 atomic number wrong. So all those who are swearing by AI, please swear off.
Okay, on your way out, what do you got coming up next, real quickly?
I'm getting ready to travel in the region related to the workshop.
Okay, Andrew.
I've said this for the last couple of times, but for this time, I am leaving on Monday to go to Australia, and I'm keeping an eye on the NCAA championship game.
Mm. Yep. I'm also going to fly out Friday. I'm going to go into Washington, D.C., and be there a week, and I will read the Project Maven book on the plane.
So with all three of us flying out, who's going to hold the fort here?
There'll be some people, I am certain. Well, we'll see you again soon. Thank you again.
Thank you.
From all of us at the Daniel K. Inouye Asia-Pacific Center for Security Studies, thank you for joining Strategic Voices. Please subscribe to receive new episodes in your feed and rate us so others can more easily find the conversation. We hope you'll join us again for the next episode of Strategic Voices. For Professor Sham Tukwani and Andrea Malji, I'm James Minnick. And until we meet again, aloha oi. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of DKI APCSS, the U.S. Department of War, or the U.S. government.